The WLEW News and Public Affairs Department now presents What Do You Think? Here's your host, Craig Routson, with today's topic.
Good morning. Our guest today in the studio, Carl Osentoski, Executive Director of the Huron County EDC, wears many hats. Actually, he helps out in Sanilac County as well, doing their EDC chores, and is constantly working with his counterparts in Tuscola County, trying to make this more of a regional thing, because
Absolutely.
That's where the bucks come in.
Yep.
So thanks for being with us.
Anytime. I say that.
I know. Where would you like to start? Do you want to start with that whole three-county regional thing? Because the commissioners on Tuesday, they passed a resolution that basically says they're good with it.
Right.
And they're passing it on to the other counties. It's sort of a sub-region of where we've now migrated to.
Right. The long story, since we've got time, is that the governor's office is trying to streamline operations across all state offices. They pulled up some maps at a presentation we were at, and they had 86 different service delivery maps for the state of Michigan.
And there's only like 83 counties, so...
Not the counties.
No, but I mean, if you're talking 86, you're talking some of them are split into two.
Oh, and what happened... Well, it's places like economic development. We had our own regional maps. And then the Michigan Works offices have their own regions, which are different than the economic development regions. Area Agency on Aging has their own regions. So pick a state department or an organization like that, and they have their own kind of regional state maps. And it was designed, you know, it made sense when they designed it. But the governor's office said, you know, that's not really a good way to deliver services. So they started to put the economic development offices into a variety of sub-regions throughout the state, just so that we can share resources, talk regionalism, how we can better coordinate our economic development services. Initially, the thumb area was put into the Great Lakes Bay region, which was the three thumb counties, Huron, Tuscola, and Sanilac, Bay Saginaw Midland, went up to Clare, down to Gratiot County, kind of that whole, I think it's about a 13 county region. So it was a large region. But as they kind of continued to evaluate all of those 86 different regional maps, they said, well, maybe we need to redo the Great Lakes Bay region. So they took the three counties of the thumb area and moved them to a different region, which was the I-69 International Trade Corridor.
Not even looking at the fact that two of those counties actually are on the Great Lakes Bay, Saginaw Bay, to begin with.
We pointed that out.
It's on every map. You don't have to go to a different map to find it that way.
Yeah, we pointed out that Huron County has quite a bit of shoreline, and that we thought that we should probably be with the Saginaw Bay. But the state looked at a variety of demographics, traffic patterns. I mean, they looked at, and in their minds, it made sense to put us with the I-69 corridor folks, which is Shiawassee, Genesee, Lapeer, and St. Clair counties. So in some aspects, you can see that that makes sense. Sanilac County has a great deal of interactivity with St. Clair County just because of Port Huron and the retail base down there. So, and the process, though, is a struggle because they've had their organization for the last 2.5 years. They've been putting a lot of time, money, and effort into marketing the I-69 corridor. But we're actually not on the I-69 corridor. And the three thumb counties...
We're an hour away from
I-69. We are. I was at a meeting yesterday. It took me an hour and a half to get down to the meeting. So what we've been negotiating with and talking with the state of Michigan, Michigan Economic Development Corporation, about is some of our conditions, some of our interest areas don't lie necessarily with the I-69 corridor. So what they've started to do is to look at providing us with a sub-region. We're still part of the larger 7-county region, but we look different. Our economy is different than... the I-69 corridor. So we're creating a thumb region, a sub-region within the thumb to look at doing special marketing or separate marketing. Somehow we're going to try to blend it into the I-69 corridor. But it's,
well, if they can give us billboards, I mean, that would be fine. Well, I mean, you know, turn left here at Imlay City, head
don't,
north.
Don't look back.
Not a problem. Right. I mean, keep going north.
And so we're building websites and kind of going through some of those mechanics. But our approaches are a little different than their approaches. So we're still kind of working through that process. And I know the commissioners.
And they're a little more industrialized and more agriculture. That makes a whole big difference, too.
It does.
Because what they're looking for is to build their industrial base there, right. The infrastructure for that. We have a whole different problem with infrastructure in a rural area because farms are big industry, but they're scattered all around.
They're scattered.
They're not in a little industrial park in Davison. Ta-da.
Yeah. Well, yeah, our agricultural area is the entire county.
Yeah.
So it does. It raises some interesting, and the issues are very, very different. So that's why we wanted to approach it as a thumb region. And we've been talking with the Huron County Board of Commissioners about some of those aspects. They were concerned when we were shifted to the I-69 corridor region initially, because we were trying to have the governor's office designate the thumb area as a separate region by itself. The state didn't want to do that. So we've been working with, and from the county's perspective, I can't speak for the commissioners, but I think their idea is to meet periodically with the other commissioners, with Sanilac and Tuscola County, to talk about some of those issues that they deal with on a regional basis as well, so that we can help coordinate some of those issues.
Well, when you go to one of the meetings with the I-69 corridor, then you've got all three counties on board. This is what we'd like to do, we'd like to try for grants to do, and all this stuff that you know, a singular voice, and you've got everybody in a chorus along that interstate. I mean, you know, you're going to get drowned out.
Right. And we're kind of bumping up against that a little bit now. There's some Department of Agriculture grants that are out for value-added agriculture. They're interested, but it doesn't impact them as directly as it impacts us. So we're kind of bumping up against that, as we'd like to apply for it as a region, but we're still working through some of the mechanics of how that might work. So it's a challenge. It's just...
Well, anytime there's change. It takes a little curve, a learning curve, to get things going again.
It does. And, you know, we're still learning their personalities. They're learning our personalities. And
oh, heaven help them.
I know. So, but it's a process. I mean, and they're very supportive. They understand that, you know, agriculture, even, you know, as from the governor's office all the way down through all of the state departments, understand that agriculture is one of the driving industries in the state of Michigan. A lot of times, in the past, Michigan Economic Development has told us agriculture is not an industry. You know, plastics manufacturing is an industry.
Who tells you this?
Well, we've had some feedback from the state, and they didn't see agriculture as an industry. We said,
well, not until the recession, when it was the only one that was actually growing and doing stuff.
And if you look at the markets, the export markets, that's what's growing in the state of Michigan, is our agricultural exports. So it's obviously a huge industry for us, and we're working every way we can to support that industry and to keep the industry growing. So it's a challenge to work through the state's organizations and say, why agriculture is an industry? It's just a bunch of farmers. And we said, yeah, but those farmers are big industry. So
do you see this as the first sort of ache and pain in this system of trying to get everybody into a sort of like one region on the map? Are we going to see the Area Agency on Aging shift? Are we going to see all these others try to go in line so that everybody's region is the same region?
Yes, we think that everybody's going to be realigned.
Eventually.
Eventually. We just happen to be the low-hanging fruit on that whole thing. Because we're kind of...
Sacrificial lamb comes to mind, but okay.
Well, maybe. But we're the easiest ones because we don't actually have any formal ties. I mean, it's just a realignment of state resources for us. They just kind of redraw the districts. With some of the other organizations, Michigan Works, for example, there are actually federal requirements for those maps and those organizations. So it's not as easy as just redrawing the map and saying, you know, we're cutting, because I think there's...
Because they're basically us in Lapeer County, aren't they?
Yes.
So they're almost half of what this region is anyway.
Exactly. And but each one of those Michigan Works organizations has a board of directors. There's federal requirements. There's 25 of, I think it's around 25 Michigan Works organizations across the state. So they would have to cut them more than half, and I don't see that happening, because some of them are county-based, especially in the more urban counties. It's one county, or it might be three counties. So just to kind of manage that shrinking process is requires federal permission to do that, and I believe some of the other organizations as well. So it's going to be a long-term process, but the first step in the process was the economic development.
Like Michigan Works, that would change their whole focus if they had to start thinking of urban inner city,
yes,
like Flint, you know,
yes,
development of jobs and such, because it's a totally different picture than out here in the thumb.
Yes, it is. So that's the challenge. That's the challenge. So, you know,
Marv will be pulling his hair out.
Marv will be pulling his hair out. I think he has already started pulling his hair out. But, you know, I think everybody's up to the challenge. Change is difficult, but sometimes good. It makes us rethink what we're doing, how we're doing it, why we're doing it. And then, you know, we take our experiences and build on them. So.
And we maybe have things to offer this I-69 corridor they didn't have before, because all of these products head that way. We can't go north.
That's been the discussion with them, is they're one of their primary industries that they've been focusing on is logistics and a lot of Canadian trade. So we're looking at how the commodities move from our area through Lapeer, Port Huron, Genesee counties, Shiawassee to a certain extent, but how those commodities move, where they move, you know, what the movements are, the volume, and how we can help expand that whole logistics effort. And it starts up here. I mean, our elevators and grain companies are the basis of those grain movements.
And that kind of brings us to another point you wanted to do in the show today, was talk about some of the infrastructure things that are going on, like rail.
Rail, yep.
We had a big rail system up here. I mean, went up to Point Au Barques from the Grand Trunk Railroad down to mm-hmm. Detroit. We had it into all the other little communities, and then all of a sudden, they were yanking tracks out and making trails and stuff, and now we find out we'd like them back.
Well,
at least yeah. Some of them.
Some of them. Thinking about that, what was the price of gas back then, or diesel? And that's what drove the process, is the logistics. I mean, trucks were much more flexible, and that was the emphasis. Cost of fuel was dramatically less than it is today. So
the Motor City town, the Michigan was cars and trucks and automobiles and all this stuff.
We didn't need trains.
They had a whole, you know, infrastructure down in Detroit back before the cars came in that was public transportation that immediately went out the window.
Exactly. So what we're looking at is how to enhance the rail service throughout the area. Some of the numbers that we've been told is that for every one grain car, it's three trucks on the road. So if we can provide, if there's more shipping by rail, it keeps those trucks off the road, keeps them from tearing up the roads just with their weight, and it allows more flexible movement. So, but it's a challenge.
And most of the time, these trucks leaving here are going someplace to put that in a rail car to take it somewhere else anyway.
Exactly. So we reduce the number of touch points in that transfer process, and it makes everything more efficient. So we started some discussions. We were at a meeting all yesterday morning talking about rail issues, you know, what the next steps should be. We'll be entering into meetings and discussions with the rail companies, because they are independent operators. They're all short lines up here. So, and all of our rail traffic goes from the Thumb area, loops into Bay City, and then goes through Saginaw to finally the Class 1 CSX or Canadian National down in Flint.
Now, we used to have lines that went around the other way of the Thumb. Didn't we go down to almost Port Huron, lost when the trucks took over and the rails went out, and we could look to have a loop there that would be kind of like our thumb loop for electric, a reliable system all the way around.
Right. That was part. We had some historic maps. We had some folks from Port Huron. Again, our partners had some resources that we didn't have, and they had historic maps. They mapped out what that rail line was, where it went, how it interconnected with CSX and CN down in Port Huron, as you said. Unfortunately, though, those connections are broken. So part of the discussion is, you know, how do we address those issues? How do we work with the rail companies to improve service, continue to enhance service up here, and, you know, look at what other options might be out there? From our friends in the agricultural industry, they said, you know, we're starting to look at more container shipping. It's not huge, but it's starting to move, especially when you start looking at different varieties and identity preserves. You want to make sure that everything remains separate, GMO versus non-GMO. So once you start looking at how all of those things, food grade containers and those type of things, and where they are exporting to, how are they moving that traffic, that's what we want to understand. And then once we understand how all of mechanics move, then we start looking at how we can work with the industry, both agriculture and the rail lines, to improve that service. And there might be some state resources, maybe some federal resources that we can bring into the discussions. But now what we're trying to do is to understand what's happening in the industry. Because I think before we came on air, we were talking about how productivity on farm has been going from, for instance, 100 bushel corn per acre to it's inching up to almost 200 now. And the discussion yesterday from the Michigan Agribusiness Association representative said that probably in the next 10 years, they'll be looking at 300 bushel an acre corn. And all of that comes into our elevators, usually within 2 to 4 weeks. They have to store it, and then they have to move it. So the challenge is how to manage and work with our industries to manage that process and to bring the resources that make sense to that industry.
And this is where people need maybe help with grants or stuff for on-farm storage when the prices get better, right, after that four-week period, right, when there's a glut and everybody's giving you the lowest price because we got plenty of it coming.
It's coming in.
You know, and you have dryers and everything, right, else to process it before you get there, so you get a better price when you, right, arrive. All of these things are economically driven to our area, right, but not necessarily the I-69
corridor. You know, and what we were told yesterday, and again, as we start learning about the process, before the rail lines wanted unit trains, which are just basically collections of cars. They started off working with our ag industry with 60-car unit trains. That's what their preference is to move those. They're now up to 90 cars, and the trend is now to 110 cars. But to store warehouse a 110-car train, or at least a section of a train, you have to have a lot of real estate for that. So, you know, how do we coordinate with our local companies to look at, you know, where they store those rail cars while they're being loaded and prepared to be shipped wherever they're shipped to? So those
maybe
are
they need
of,
another side rail to, right, to store them until they're ready to be hooked up to the main train to take them on out of here.
Right, because that's typically not the railroad's responsibilities. The sidings are all whoever's shipping locally. So it'd be the grain elevators. It could be industrial manufacturers. We want to start some discussions with some of our manufacturing industry to look at if there's some opportunities that they may want to ship by rail if that rail service was quicker, more efficient, bigger.
You have three truckloads going down. That's one rail car right there.
Right. So, and you start looking at those. So that's why we want to kind of understand the mechanics of putting those pieces together and then working with the industry, both rail and ag and manufacturing, to look at how we can better improve that service.
And I don't think we're looking at anything like when you go down to like Imlay City, you see these trains moving at a pretty good clip.
Right.
We're kind of, you know, town to town around here. They can't even get up to that speed before, so we're not going to be having these high-speed trains bulleting through the area. We just need the tracks that can take a nice long train to where it needs to get
to. And even, yesterday was a great meeting because I learned lots of things. Rail cars are actually getting bigger, and so that the rail lines have to accommodate not just longer trains, but bigger train cars. They
kind of what the Sioux locks had to go through when they got bigger ships. They had to build bigger locks to accommodate them.
Exactly. So that's where our challenge is to kind of understand all of those little pieces, put them all together, and then work with the industry to say, okay, how do we solve some of these issues? What makes sense for agriculture? What makes sense for manufacturers? And what makes sense for the rail industry? Because they're under federal and state restrictions as well.
And what makes sense for a small rural community as opposed to a big metropolitan area where...
Exactly. You know, do you want a huge volume of trucks or you want a 110-car rail train going through town? So we want to understand all of those pieces. You know, where does it make sense to locate some of these facilities? How often are they used? Because you don't want to overbuild infrastructure. You want something that's usable but not overbuilt.
Maybe for multi-use when you're not using them during the normal harvest season when they're going to be in prime
right.
use. Maybe a nearby facility can utilize them to do different types of materials to be taken
right.
elsewhere.
So that's our challenge. That's what keeps me awake at night is thinking about this stuff. So,
Carl, get some sleep.
I know. Every once in a while it says sleep would be good.
Some of the other things we were going to talk about was natural gas.
Yep.
Everybody likes to know that when winter comes around, the heat's going to be there.
Seems like
we've
an appropriate
had a pretty
time.
Reliable service, yep. but every time somebody builds a new house or somebody builds a new plant or a new grain dryer, that little pipeline coming in here just looks all a bit smaller.
Right, and this has been an ongoing issue, at least from the EDC's perspective, for the last 15 or 20 years. We've had a lot of discussions with the Public Service Commission. We've started, again, some additional discussions with Consumers Energy about how do we manage that whole process? How do they manage it? And so what we're trying to do is to determine, you know, what their expectations are for information. You know, do we know of a new manufacturing facility that's going to be going in? You know, and feed that information back to them so that they can start building some modeling for infrastructure improvements. You know, how big is that pipe? Where does it have to go? Can they do something a little different to address some of the issues? Because it is a challenge. A lot of the infrastructure that was put into place in the Upper Thumb area dates back to the early to mid-1960s. And there's been some improvements, especially from the residential side, but from the transmission side, which are the big pipes, there hasn't been a lot of improvements. We've seen some down towards Akron, actually. That has helped the area immensely. But we're looking at additional loads, as you said, grain dryers keep coming online. And the challenge for consumers is how do they manage that for a wet, cold fall, that all the grain dryers start kicking on, and then, you know, after a month or two, they shut down. You don't need them anymore. So they have to kind of manage that load, and it's a challenge for them. I mean, because of how seasonal that load is, not just winter loading with 20-degree temperatures, but especially the agricultural loading. And they like to have manufacturers that use gas on a regular basis, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, because that's easy to plan for. So when they look at process gas versus, you know, seasonal use, it's a challenge for them. So what we're trying to do is to coordinate our activity with Tuscola County, because the pipeline comes through, out of Akron up to Seaboing Road and then kind of splits off from there.
So it's kind of like, you know, when you had the old houses with knob and tube wiring. It was adequate in the day if you only had a couple of lights you were running
right.
and maybe an old tube radio.
Right.
Try and run today's stuff on it and away you go.
Exactly.
You're heating the house through the radiant heat in the walls because it's just not built for that.
Exactly. And so, you know, and the industry's gotten much more efficient at using those things, but there's continual loads being put on the system that we don't think it was originally designed for. So that's why we've started our discussions again with Consumers Energy about how do they address that, and what can we do to help support that change?
Is the Thumb Loop for electricity taking care of your concerns on the electric level?
Yes.
I know you've had those in the past. We had to get a special line into like Huron Castings or something.
Huron
you had casting. To get a grant for that.
We did.
Just so the firm could expand and do what they do.
We did.
Because the people in between them and the former site got tired of brownouts.
Well, you know, the flickering lights, it might be disturbing. But yes, the ITC thumb loop will address a lot of the stability issues, because that was one of the major concerns. Once that's completed, we feel pretty confident that, I mean, we can manage the loads coming in or going out. I mean, as the wind industry continues to mature and develop up here, that was, I think, some of the original thought. But as we kind of thought through this, it also adds a great deal of stability and support for our manufacturers. So again, what we're looking at doing is how do we, once that's completed, how do we market the area as having almost unlimited electrical capabilities?
The thumb area, we're juiced.
I might use that. I like that.
One of the other problems you've had in the past is these manufacturers and businesses come up here, they need high-speed internet, and they need high-speed transfer of data and such.
Yes.
Fiber optics is the key these days. I know we've had some work being done even right in front of our station here. They're working on getting fiber optics through. Are we getting closer to your goals on that for making this more attractive to business coming in?
We far surpassed our goals. We wanted broadband 10 years ago, and we fought really hard with the folks at MEDC who said, what's this broadband stuff? Because it's important for us, because we are a rural community. We need that connectivity back to that larger global community. And what we've been blessed, to be honest, with the amount of fiber that's actually being put in the ground. Agra Valley Services from Pigeon has been in the process of connecting their cell phone towers with fiber, provides us, number one, with 4G service, and provides that backbone capability for the telecommunications for broadband. And that's important because what they're able to do then is connect an industry to that fiber optic network. Air Advantage is the second player in this, and out of Frankenmuth received a federal grant to install fiber throughout the area. I think their system is 300 miles of fiber. And again, those two systems give us enormous amounts of capabilities within the area. The nice part is when we're talking with industries, they like redundant kind of systems. They don't, if you know, somebody's out digging in their front yard and they cut a fiber line, you want something that's a backup. And having two providers out there with separate systems provides us with that system redundancy.
It also supplies them with something they like. You know, they can go out and shop. They're not tied to one person. You know, these are the rates and this is what you get. They can, we're a heavy user. We're going to be here 20 years. You know, what kind of deal can you, I mean, that's how business works.
Competition is good. it makes everybody that much better. I think you look at service rates, you look at service capabilities. So it keeps everybody very, very competitive. But from our standpoint, it also gives us another one of those pieces. Like with the ITC loop, it gives us another marketing tool to say, you know, you can enjoy all of the attributes of a rural area and still be connected via high-speed internet to the rest of the world. No lag time. It's beneficial for our healthcare industry, beneficial for our schools, but especially for private sector businesses. So we're looking at working with the industry, working with the folks that have installed the fiber, to identify where, in a general sense, where that fiber is, so that we can start marketing that capability to that larger community. You look at our shoreline communities, I mean, people want to be by the water. So if we can put a fiber optic service on the water, and these people can come up, start their businesses, it could be consulting businesses, application development, programmers, they can move that information and data, you know, at true high-speed capabilities anywhere in the world.
So that's, between those three, that's a pretty big leg we got there.
Yes, it's a huge advantage.
Now, the other things that most industries coming in are going to need to know about is, do they have adequate water, do they have adequate disposal?
Mm-hmm.
And those are the things that a lot of the communities do, and I know you help communities, you know, when they're looking at, you know, do we have room for this type of expansion? What do we do to have more room in our septic sewer system to take care of it? All these types of things, they also fall into play because businesses need proper disposal.
And that's always a challenge for us, because we'll see, business leads come through Michigan Economic Development, will send us opportunities. And what we try to do and what we have to do is match, what the industry is looking for with the local capabilities. For instance, Dairy Farmers of America are opening a facility over in Cass City. The load on their septic system required that the city vastly improve their wastewater treatment system to the tune of about $8 million.
Now, the company, as I understand it, in this case, is defraying a lot of that cost.
They're paying
because
for some.
They need this, but they need the location too, so it
correct.
All works out.
And the village will and the Cass City will recoup a lot of that by service fees for the industry. So, but it's a long-term process, and what we try to do, as they did over there, is to match that up as closely as possible. So, if an industry comes in and says, "I don't need a lot of sewer capacity, but I really need a lot of water," then that kind of drives us to, who has that capability? Are the communities on wells? What are the capability of those wells? What kind of water quality are coming out of those wells? Is it on a lake intake system? What's the capabilities? What's the water quality of that? What's the volume of water? And that kind of drives the process of where we start looking at trying to locate those industries.
And how big of a pipeline goes to where you want to place it. Because, if it's only 6 inches in diameter and you need something a lot bigger than that, then you're looking at a whole dig up and that's added cost.
Right, absolutely. So that's what we try to balance out. Water lines up here are typically a little easier to work with because we do have pretty good water. Sewer capacities are always a challenge because then you start looking at, when I started this job, I didn't want to know about BOD loadings and hydraulic loadings or anything else. That just came with the territory, I guess. But you start looking at, what kind of organic matter might be in that wastewater coming out of that factory. How much water is going to be going out? Can there be pre-treatment? So there's a lot of mechanics, a lot of moving parts when we start looking at that. But I think our communities have been very, very progressive about the investment in their local infrastructure. And, and again, it kind of goes back to what we were talking about before. You don't want to over-design and overbuild, but you want something that can serve today's needs and anticipate tomorrow's needs. So
you plan ahead, you have extra land around your treatment
right.
facilities. If you need an extra lagoon or other
exactly.
systems, you're not looking to have to buy out, people's houses and stuff. It's
exactly.
farmland that if you can pick it up, you pick it up and rent it out until you need it.
Exactly. So that's the challenge to the local communities is, how do you kind of balance that out? You don't want to overspend, but you also want to anticipate that there could be some growth, but you don't want to put that capacity in until there is growth. So that's where we come in. We can help with maybe acquiring some grants if there's a new company coming in to improve the wastewater treatment system, to improve the water lines and do those kind of things.
Do you find most of the towns are really open? They want new industry in? Because we are a small town community
mm-hmm.
and we don't want a town to become the next, Rouge facility down in Detroit or anything. You know what I mean? There's a balance in our lifestyle
mm-hmm.
and the manufacturing industry we'd like to get in here.
Right. I think every community that we work with, and we work with all communities in both counties, it goes, interestingly enough, it goes through cycles. We'll spend a lot of time in one community and then that'll kind of taper off and we'll be in another community. But for the most part, I think communities are very open to discussing the kinds of attraction opportunities, expansion opportunities that they have. A lot of times, this is kind of some of the tension that we feel in with our friends down in the I-69 corridors, because we don't do a lot of attraction. We work with the utilities, but we try to balance that. A lot of our growth comes from companies that are already here. 80% of the growth that comes from the companies that are already here. So we spend a lot of time working with existing companies. That's why we're focused on agriculture, because agriculture's here. I mean, they're a big driver. We work with a lot of the local industries on how we can support their existing operations, and if there's ever an opportunity for them to grow that operation, we want to be standing there ready to help them. Because it's difficult to attract large industries. a Rouge complex. Or,
use that as a big example, but I mean,
But it changes the character of the communities. I mean, and that's not what rural life is about. We like to be able to, you know, walk down the street. We, you know, don't need traffic. But, you know, when you start balancing it out, you still want to start looking at locations. The DFA plant will generate a lot of truck traffic. So, you know, it's in their industrial park, and they've done a lot of planning on how to move those trucks in and out.
And they're right on a state highway when they get done with their industrial park. So they're not, you're not looking to upgrade a road to Class A status, you know, to get you from the industrial park to a state trunk line.
To do 20 miles of Class A road. Sure. So that's kind of the balancing act that we're always kind of working through, is how do we do that? How do we manage that? If we had rail, we could probably move it just as effectively, more effectively. So it's trying to work through some of those, balancing all of the needs of the communities and looking at the scale of the communities. And every community has a different personality. And it's fun to work with the communities because they look at things a little differently. The community is set up differently. Some have large industrial parks. Others have very small industrial parks, if they have any industrial capacity at all. We're looking at, you know, what we can do for downtowns. There's a lot of empty storefronts in some of our downtowns. So how do we work with the local communities, with downtown development authorities, chambers of commerce, and cities and villages on filling those stores? Again, keeping in mind that those are all privately owned buildings. So we try to balance all of those things out.
A lot of times they seek you out because, you know, you can say, you know, gee, I wish you could do something with this, but to actually do something for them, they have to be willing partners.
Have to be willing partners. And, you know, we constantly look at what resources available that might be available that we haven't used. We haven't used a lot of the Michigan State Housing Development Authority programs because we don't have a housing organization up here. Human Development Commission does some housing, but we're looking at, you know, doing downtown second floor renovations.
And you have to look at the strings attached to some of this stuff, too, because a lot of the stuff, you know, works fine in an urban area, but in a small rural community, you know, you have requirements that would be difficult or make it not worth doing.
And a lot of times what we found, too, is we try to attract developers because, you know, we read the same news stories and listen to the news stories about what's going on in downtown Flint or downtown Detroit. So we kind of look at, you know, the developer community as a prime opportunity. One of our challenges, though, is that, you know, we may have a building, you know, that might have two or three apartments upstairs and a small retail commercial space downstairs. It's not big enough to gather their attention. They want huge projects in downtown Detroit where it might be 100 apartments or 100 lofts. We don't, to get three is a real challenge. So that's one of our struggles, is because we're a rural community, we can only offer maybe a building or two.
You need like rural flippers.
Right.
Flip the building.
They'll
fix it up and you know, sell it and have the rental space above as part of the...
As part of the cash flow deal. Sure. So that's our challenge, is to try to identify people who are interested. And it's a risky venture because the process looks a lot different in a rural community than in an urban community.
There was a lot more people who could take advantage of this particular building than around here.
Exactly. You look at population densities and the needs of those populations. I mean, it looks dramatically different. And, you know, we're small rural. You know, 3,000 in the city of Bad Axe might, you know, be a neighborhood. You know, where it's an entire city up here. So it's a challenge.
One of the other things you wanted to talk about was the DTE power plant.
Yep.
Basically, you can consult, but you can't sign anything because it's not your property, basically.
It's not our property.
But you can partner with them, and that's how you work a lot with business, is partnering with them.
Absolutely. And our role, we coordinate with the city of Harbor Beach all the time on trying to encourage Detroit Edison to look at that power plant because it is shut down. They're no longer generating power. And so we want to understand the process. Marysville, which was the last plant that Detroit Edison shut down, took 15 years to go from where they shut it down to they think finally they have a identified developer for reuse. we don't want to wait 15 years.
No, because the building goes down and it becomes an eyesore, and you want the community to look thriving.
Absolutely. And it's a...
Especially in your harbor.
It's got some really unique assets, not just the harbor. It has a massive lake intake system that was used at the power plant for cooling. We're looking at that as an asset. It's acreage on with waterfront. So we're encouraging Detroit Edison to consider what the community is interested in supporting. And what the process has been is Detroit Edison made the announcement. They just finished a request for information, which was kind of a request for proposal, but not quite.
Right.
So they evidently gathered some interest. There's a lot of folks that expressed interest, submitted ideas. They're in the process now of doing some environmental consulting. Doing some soil borings, trying to determine, if the site is contaminated, where it's contaminated, how much is it contaminated, and starting to address that.
Because, you know, when you have a plant in there for that many years, I mean, in the old days you had PCBs and transformers and stuff, there may be, you might not actually know everything, you know, that's in there, and these things have to be done.
And it was a coal plant, so there's a coal pile setting over there. They stored fly ash from burning the coal, so all of those pieces. I mean, it's just the nature of industry to have, you know, some contamination. And so
is it something, though, you really think in the long run is going to end up being industrial again, would it bode well for maybe a hotel or something?
Well, and that's been there's been a lot of ideas, and
because it'd be nice to have a nice conference place right on the water with, you know, some accommodations right there. I know the town has a harbor and an arena and the camping, but as far as, and I'm not trying to drive the other little motels out of business, but if you know what I mean.
Sure. It's nice to have a destination hotel where people will come in. So those ideas have all been talked about. We're not sure what the proposals that were given to Detroit Edison are. We requested it. They said no, it's too early in the process because all of that could change. We don't want to raise expectations of, you know, it's going to be a destination, a hotel, and it turns out to be something different. So they want, and I understand that coming from the company's perspective, but to kind of work through those issues. And our job, I mean, because it is their facility, it's their real estate, is to try to encourage them to move the process along quickly, because it did impact not just from job creation or job loss, but it's a hit on the tax base for both the community and the county. So what we wanted to do is to kind of push them along as quickly as possible. We understand that they have their own internal processes, and
the gears often move slowly and assuredly.
More slowly than I would like, and the community would like. But we try to move them along. My commitment is to call them once a week and just say, what's going on? We're interested. We want
to
move
it
along.
And to be fair, they just had the last power generation there a week or two ago. So, I mean, it isn't like it's been sitting for 5 years. I mean, they're still in the process. I don't have to be patient. they're still in the process probably of getting their equipment out of there that they do want to salvage and take elsewhere.
Oh, that's a long process, and we understand. And there's, you know, lots of infrastructure going into that. There's power lines going in that need to be addressed. So there's lots of pieces to this.
There's a substation there. Whoever gets it's going to have power.
That's true. You know, but my job is not to be patient. My job is to push them along as quickly as we can, where they feel comfortable making the decisions, but also that it reflects what the community wants. So, again, my job is to continue to kind of push them along as quickly as they can.
And you work with the city on this. It's not just you. I mean, this is a whole community type of thing going
absolutely.
On.
Absolutely. We coordinate on a regular basis, talk with the community about this. If we talk to the company, we make sure that the city is involved either, you know, with a report of my discussion or... if at all possible, we try to make sure that the city is in that discussion with us, that they're sitting at the table with us. So it's a constant dialogue with the community because, to be honest, it's their community. They want to make sure that what is on that site reflects what the community needs from an economics perspective and that the community will support it.
And part of the process is what kind of slows it down as well. You got to get everybody together to be updated and all this stuff.
So, exactly. I mean,
it's not a perfect system.
Right. And we work through it. That's just, you know, but we try to work through it more quickly than slowly.
Okay. We're getting close to the end of our time here. Your incubator's still going at the
Still doing ISD. Well. We are coordinating with the folks at the tech center.
You're looking for more people who may have ideas of some, how would you put it, food ag-related product food. That they want to create there and distribute?
Yes, always. Because it's not necessarily an easy process to use that, because what we try to do is, you know, if you had your jam that you wanted to package and sell, the process is that you would apply. There's an application online on our website for using that kitchen. Then what you have to do is you have to take what's called a ServSafe certification, which basically means that you understand how to handle food safely. That's a test that can be given at the tech center. Also, there's coordination with the MSU Product Center. So if the jam needs to be tested for nutritional values and all of that stuff, so for the labeling, we help direct folks to that. Then there's also insurance responsibilities that they have to have. They have to have $1 million policy, which is affordable. It sounds like a lot of money, but it truly is affordable. And then finally, Michigan Department of Agriculture has to license that food product to that kitchen.
And you also have to schedule time between the other people who are already using it, when the school isn't using it, and all of these other logistics go into play, too.
And that's becoming more of a challenge. As we add people to the kitchen, that time is getting more and more competitive. I just talked to a gentleman this morning who's now thinking that if they can start the sales of, it's a new hot sauce company, that if they can get into some commercial markets, they may be in that kitchen 3 days a week. They're not there yet, but they're already starting to think about.
And that's what you like to see.
Absolutely. And, you know, we were talking about that. We may not be able to have them in that kitchen 3 days a week. And the nice part is that they would look at building a facility here.
We are getting close to the end of our time. Okay. If people have questions about what we talked about, call the EDC. Your number is?
269-6431.
And obviously don't try tomorrow. Tomorrow won't be there.
I'll be full of turkey.
But give them a chance and call them if you have questions or if you have projects or things you'd like to see for your business or your community. Carl may be the first step to getting the funding and getting everything ready for you.
Absolutely.
Thanks for being with us.
Anytime.
Our guest on the program today, Carl Asantosky, Executive Director of the Huron County EDC, Economic Development Corporation. I do want you to stay tuned. Coming up at the top of the hour, 11 o'clock, we will clue you in on all the latest in the news. Current temperature at WLEW is now at 22 degrees.